When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome back to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpaw and I am thrilled because I have back with me today the one and only Dr. Micah Sando from The Ohio State University, and listeners will be impressed that he has ventured out solo without his fellows today. So it's just me and Mike, and we have a really exciting topic. We're going to talk about the total artificial heart, which Mike has become somewhat of an expert on and is going to share a lot of really great information, not only for folks who may be dealing with these in terms of implantation, but for anyone out there who may have a patient in the future who has one of these and is coming in for non-cardiac surgery. So, Mike, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Oh, thank you so much, Jed. It's always a pleasure to be on ACRAC.
All right. Well, let's jump right in. And I should say, of course, folks who are frequent listeners will know that you are a professor of cardiac anesthesiology at Ohio State University. So obviously very much in the know about these topics. So let's start with the very basics. When we say total artificial heart, I mean, you know, in a way, this is kind of like the dream, right, for an organ that needs to be transplanted. I mean, if we could just make a kidney or make a liver, we would be able to, you know, do away with the waiting list, right? So a heart is another thing we transplant into people who need a transplant. And it sounds like when we say total artificial heart, we are making one. Is that right? Is this a heart we can transplant into someone that is created from scratch?
All right. So I would like to say, first of all, you know, at Ohio State, you know, we have a pretty robust mechanical support and transplant program. It's led by Dr. Nahush Mokadam and Dr. Brian Whitson. So I give a lot of credit to, you know, surgeons, because, you know, based on their really robust program, we on the anesthesia, you know, aspect of things can learn a lot about these technologies such as the total artificial heart. So essentially, what is a total artificial heart? It's actually a mechanical circulatory support device that replaces the ventricles. So despite the fact that it's named a total artificial heart, it's a total artificial heart because it takes over the physiologic functions of the heart, but the device still, it has two ventricles that are essentially anastomosed to the left atria and the right atria, and then the right pump is connected to the pulmonary artery, and then the left pump is, you know, connected systemically, you know, to the aorta. So it's a pretty phenomenal device that essentially provides circulatory support. It's a durable pump that's available for patients with biventricular heart failure. So it's different from, you know, left ventricular devices, intra-aortic balloon pumps, in the sense that this is the only device that provides circulatory support to both ventricles. And a little historical perspective on the total artificial. So the device was designed in the late 50s to 1960s by a phenomenal a surgeon from Argentina, Dr. Domingo Leota. And he was working with the great Dr. DeBakey over in Houston. And then they essentially created a total artificial heart. But the first implant was by another famous cardiac surgeon, Dr. Denton Cooley. It was in 1969. And it was in a patient who also a lot of, you know, people in cardiac surgery would know about, Mr. Haskell Karp, who had a refractory biventricular heart failure. You know, he underwent surgery, they did resection of some of the ventricles, but after they put the heart back together, you know, they didn't have enough, you know, myocardium to essentially provide enough, you know, stroke volume to support the patient. So it was either the patient, sorry to say, you know, passed away on the table, or they implant a device that could support him as a bridge to heart transplantation. So they did implant the device in 1969. The patient did well for 3 days, and then he ended up, you know, undergoing heart transplantation, and he did very well. So it was a great bridge to heart transplantation. And since then, the device has been refined over the years, and it's still what we use today.
Really? So that same idea. Now, I don't know why I had in my head that this is new, but I guess not really, right? 1969. Is it newly kind of being used more, or did I just not know about it?
Perfect. So after 1969, the next implant was in the 1980s. And then it basically underwent a few refinements by different companies. And Syncardia, the company that owns the Todai Fisher Heart now, received FDA approval in 2004 to use, you know, the Todai Fisher Heart as a bridge to heart transplantation. So it's been around. Actually, it's been around since 1969. The technology, even though it's been refined, it's pretty much simple. And we'll go over the design of the pumps, you know, in a few, but it's essentially not that different from what was designed by, you know, Dr. Liotta and, you know, Dr. DeBakey, and obviously Dr. Denton Cooley helped with the refinements too. And it's really a phenomenal pump. It has its limitations, and it also has a lot of value to patients with biventricular heart failure, because these patients really do not have any other options. It's either you keep them in the hospital and you put, you know, a mechanical circulatory support that supports both the right ventricle and the left ventricle, such as a VA ECMO. But unfortunately, the downside of something like VA ECMO is the patients have to be bed bound till a heart's available. So if it's going to take a week, a month, you essentially have the patient in the hospital waiting the heart. However, the Todai Fisher Heart, the newer system, has a freedom driver, it's a portable driver that the patient can undergo implant and then can go home and come back whenever there's a transplant. There's actually a report of a patient living for 6 years with the Todai Fisher Heart and final, you know, as a bridge to transplantation. So it's a very durable pump. And the 1 year survival range is close to, you know, 60%, and it's all dependent on, you know, the center. So the experience of the center makes a huge difference. Obviously, the experience of, you know, anesthesiologists, surgeons, all the heart team in these centers impact, you know, survival and outcomes.
Wow. Amazing. 6 years. All right. So how many, I mean, give us a general idea. How many global implants do you think have there been? I mean, obviously you said there was one in 1969, one in the 80s. But like, what are we talking about? Hundreds, thousands?
Yeah. So as of, I think, a month ago, there were 2,030 global implants. And of the 2030, 400 patients had been discharged home with the Freedom Driver. So it's still, you know, not a huge population, considering that we have over 100,000 patients with, you know, terminal heart failure that need heart transplantation. And also to put in perspective, we only transplant close to 4,000 hearts a year. So we have a lot of patients that would benefit from, you know, with biventricular heart failure, end stage, you know, biventricular heart failure, that would benefit from such a device as they await, you know, heart transplantation.
All right. So we've talked about in the past a lot of different mechanical circulatory support systems. We've talked about the Impella. Certainly, you've talked about ECMO, LVADs. I don't know that we've done a specific episode on intra-aortic balloon pumps, but folks know those are out there. So there's a lot of mechanical circulatory support systems. How does this differ from those?
Well, excellent. So when you talk about, I'll just explain a little bit about heart failure. So there's a little more personalization to heart failure definition. So it used to be that we say heart failure. Now there's heart failure with preserved EF, heart failure with, you know, with low EF, reduced ejection fraction. And when you start characterizing these patients, those with left ventricular dysfunction, so end-stage left ventricular heart failure, right, with preserved or mild right ventricular dysfunction, these patients have a lot of options. So they can get a left ventricular assist device. And the left ventricle assist device essentially assists the function of the left ventricle, but the native left ventricle is left in place. Same thing if you put an intra-aortic balloon pump in. You essentially place the intra-aortic balloon pump in a retrograde fashion into the aorta, and then it assists both, you know, it basically inflates in diastole, and it supplies both the right and left ventricle with blood flow and assists. And also helps unload the left ventricle to some scale. So these, and then the Impella also assists. We have two Impella platforms. We have the Impella support for the right, which P, and then we have three or four Impella ports for the left ventricle, such as the CP, the 5, 5.5, and the LD. And they provide support for the left ventricle. So we have these different platforms, but they all work by keeping the native heart in place. So they assist the native failing heart, but they do not totally replace the native ventricle. So the total artificial heart is a very unique device because it's the only one that really functions without any native ventricle. It doesn't rely on any native conduction. It does not rely on any native, essentially, heartbeat. So you program the beat rate, and then it also has a vacuum assistance for, you know, filling, and then it also uses a drive pressure to push, you know, blood out of it. So it's a totally unique device, and that's why it's really implying a few centers who have, where they have, you know, the expertise both in anesthesiology and surgery, so these patients can undergo, you know, safe surgeries. And then you need a perfusion team and also nurses, physical therapists, so they can help rehabilitate these patients because there is no destination therapy for the total artificial heart. So every patient that undergoes a total artificial heart is being bridged to undergo heart transplantation at some time. So it's just a unique device by itself. And I would say that currently the only FDA-approved total artificial heart is the Syncardia total artificial heart. However, there are other companies that are working to create other devices in this space. So there's a Carmat, which is a French company, and their device was received approval in Europe as a total artificial heart. And then also the BiVACOR, which is being investigated in the United States. And Duke University just implanted a Carmat total artificial heart a year ago. And I think University of Louisville has also implanted too. So the FDA trial for Carmat approval in the United States, I think it's the goal for enrollment is about 10 patients. They've enrolled, I think, three. And hopefully we would have another artificial heart for commercial use pretty soon.
Are there substantial differences, do you know, Mike, between the Syncardia and the others?
Yeah, excellent. So the Syncardia pump is pneumatically driven, so it relies on air delivery to diaphragm to, you know, eject blood out of the ventricle, and it uses vacuum to help fill the pump in diastole. The Carmat is pretty unique because it uses fluid. So it's more, it doesn't use air, it uses fluid. And also the Syncardia has mechanical valves, so it requires a higher scale of anticoagulation. So it has four mechanical valves. They're called Sinhal valves in the native, quote-unquote, tricuspid pulmonic and the mitral and aortic positions, whereas the Carmat device uses bioprosthetic valves. So it's more, the Carmat device is more hemocompatible, so there's less hemolysis, which may translate to less thromboembolic complications, which is one of the Achilles' heels of the Syncardia pump. And it also, it's also pretty neat in the sense, I haven't personally implanted one or been in where they implanted one, but by reading about it, it has autoregulation. So Syncardia's pump does not autoregulate. So if you need a higher stroke volume or a higher heart rate, it has to be programmed. But the Carmat has the ability, it has integrated sensors, and it can basically modulate, you know, the rate, the fill volume, and other hemodynamic, you know, parameters. And then the BiVACOR, that is It's designed similar to the continuous flow, similar to the continuous flow vats, where it has like magnetically levitated, impeller, and then it uses that pump to pump blood both to the right, to the pulmonic circulation and to the systemic circulation. So these are really phenomenal platforms that hopefully will be available for use, pretty soon.
Right. Yeah. And so it's almost like a rate responsive pacemaker, right? Is what you're describing with the one that's responsive, so that it can sense when a patient is perhaps exercising and would increase the cardiac output, which seems pretty important if someone's going to have this and go home and live a life.
Yes. So yes. Yeah. The combat device provides the added benefit of being, the ability to auto-regulate. So yeah, it can respond to the hemodynamic needs of the patient. So if they need a higher cardiac output, it can, supply that. And if the patient is sleeping, it can also de-escalate the support. So it's pretty neat. The Duke guys in Louisville are key to have experienced this, and hopefully, knowing my surgeons, they will bring it to Ohio State soon.
Very cool. All right. So what patients are eligible for a total artificial heart?
Yes. So the total artificial heart has actually a wide eligibility. So patients with end stage, left ventricular failure and end stage right ventricular failure have no other durable pump options. So these patients essentially are candidates for the total artificial heart. But other patients include, for example, if you have a patient who undergoes a left ventricular assist device, and over time, if the right ventricle fails, then the native right ventricle cannot supply the LVAD with its preload. So then they end up in right heart failure. So patients with LVADs who develop RV dysfunction are candidates for the total artificial heart. Other group of patients are VAD patients who develop pump thrombosis, which is refractory to standard approaches to treatment with either, thrombolytics or surgical techniques. And also we have a few VAD patients who have refractory ventricular arrhythmias. So patients with VADs who develop refractory ventricular tachycardia and refractory ventricular fibrillation, because of these ventricular arrhythmias, the right ventricle cannot supply the left ventricle and the pump with the volume it needs to eject to support the patient's, cardiac output. So there's a wide scale. And then currently there are a lot of patients with adult, congenital heart disease who are actually undergoing TAH implantation. So we have failed Fontans who are, receiving TAH because when these congenital palliative surgeries fail as an adult, LVADs, if you have a single ventricle physiology, LVADs may not be enough to, support the patient's circulation, especially when they have like a passive delivery of blood, like, from the Fontan into the pulmonary circulation. So once the Fontan is failing, if you have an LVAD, it's really futile to support the hemodynamics. So the TAH becomes one of the few platforms that can support the patient till there's an organ available for implantation. So it's still not a destination therapy. They cannot be sent home forever, even though, people have lived with it for 3 to 6 years, because some of these patients have high panel reactive antibodies. So trying to match them for a donor organ takes longer than usual. So we really don't have an idea about the longevity of the pump, but we know that it can, support the patient for up to 6 years.
Right. Are there any absolute contraindications, patients who just can't get this?
Yes. So in my opinion, the most absolute contraindication is a patient that is not a candidate for anticoagulation. So the TAH, because of the four mechanical valves, the Sinhal valves, and it has a diaphragm that separates the egg chamber. It's a four-layered polyurethane diaphragm that separates the blood chamber from the air chamber. So it's not as hemocompatible. So you have a risk of thrombus forming in either on the diaphragm layer or also on the mechanical valve. So they need Coumadin with a goal INR of 2.5 to 3. So if the patient is really not a candidate for anticoagulation therapy, they cannot receive the Syncardia total artificial heart. And hopefully the CARMAT device would be the option for patients that do not meet anticoagulation criteria. And then you also have to be on an antiplatelet. So most centers, including ours, use either a TEG or a Rotem, so a viscoelastic testing to ensure that these patients really develop, you know, platelet inhibition from aspirin. So, and the dosing of aspirin ranges from 80, you know, the basic 81 to 324, 325 milligrams. It's more based on the, it's a little bit outside the scope of us anesthesiologists, but most surgeons dose aspirin based on the patient's response with viscoelastic testing of the platelet mapping.
Right. So you have to be able to tolerate lifelong anticoagulation and antiplatelet.
Yes, yes. Yes, essentially so. You have to be able to receive anticoagulation, antiplatelet. One other relative contraindication to the TAH, which is a little more relative, is a lot of times the TAH is implanted as really a late-stage life-saving device. So if a patient has developed, you know, right-sided heart failure with cardiohepatic and cardiorenal failure, a lot of times when you put a TAH in, they may not do well. So some centers view this as a relative contraindication to implant the device because it doesn't help rehabilitate the patient because the patient may be too sick for the pump. And also totally terminal right heart failure is debatable, but I think that's actually, you know, depending on the center, I think that's one of the needs for the total artificial heart. It's just analogous to LVADs via ECMO. When you identify a patient in a streamers for biventricular heart failure, it's important for the heart team to get together and implant these devices sooner, like have a strategy in place rather than wait till you develop multi-system organ failure and put the device in and hope for the device to save the patient because it provides circulatory support, but it does not really help bring, you know, sorry to say, like, you know, really dead kidneys, dead liver back to life.
Right. So, Mike, this sounds like the device is primary or really is two ventricles. It's a right ventricle and a left ventricle. You said it's anastomosed to the native atria. So is it pretty much passive flow through the atria to these ventricles, or do you get an atrial kick? Is there a way in which the native, even with all this stuff anastomosed to them, do the native atria still give you a natural kick? Do you get an atrial beat? And then along those same lines, you know, is there a way that the device can sense the atrial beat and then kind of sync up so you have some AV synchrony or not?
Oh, perfect. So I'll just go over a little bit of the implantation, if that's okay. So
yeah, please.
So when the patient, so from the anesthesiologist's point of view, hemodynamic monitoring is critical. Obviously, any patient with profound cardiogenic shock on multiple inotropes and vasopressors come artificial heart would have an arterial line in and it will have a central line in. It's quite critical to avoid either placement of a pulmonary artery catheter or if there's a pulmonary artery catheter in place to remove it because the mechanical valves of the total artificial heart can totally get dysfunctional if a PA catheter lodges into it. And that would totally is the function of the pump, and unfortunately, the patient would arrest. So during implantation, the surgeons obviously would guide you and make sure you don't place a PA catheter. However, if you encounter a patient with a total artificial heart who comes to your hospital and you want to place, you know, hemodynamic monitors, it's very critical. Do not put a PA catheter in. And if you're going to place a central line, I would say it's better to use a femoral access, right? So that your wire potential would not even get close to the sinhole valve in the tricuspid, you know, position. So I know this is a little bit of an aside, but this is really critical. And when we do lines in these patients, we use fluoroscopy guidance, and then we also use transesophageal echo. So you can monitor the relationship between the guide wire and the mechanical valve in the tricuspid, you know, position. So surgical anastomosis wise, it starts off by doing a atrioventriculectomy. So the native right ventricle, the native left ventricle are totally resected. And then the coronary sinus is also oversewn. And some patients that have like baseline atrial fibrillation or any atrial myopathy with large, you know, left atrial appendages, routinely the surgeons would oversew the left atrial appendage because there's really no contribution of the left atrium mechanically to the filling of the pumps. So there is no AV conduction after you implant these ventricles. It's totally a rigid plastic, and there's no electrical communication between either the left atrium and the left TAH ventricle or the right atrium and the right TAH ventricle. So no communication, right atrium anastomosis to the inflow of the right TAH ventricle. And then the pulmonary artery is quickly, they have these quick connects and a graft. So you sew a graft to the pulmonary artery because the pulmonic valve is gone. So you sew the graft from the flow of the right TAH ventricle to the pulmonic, you know, artery. And then you sew the mitral to the inflow of the, you know, the TAH left ventricle. And then you anastomose the aorta to the outflow of the TAH left ventricle. So there's no native ventricles involved, four mechanical ventricles. Totally the beat rate or the heart rate is controlled by the, you know, the implanter. And since there's no autoregulation, the TAH beat rate or the heart that is selected has to be greater than 110 to 130. So you range, most of the time you put it close to 120. And the rationale for that is if you end up in a hypovolemic state at some point, the TAH does not sense it to really augment its beat rate. It has to be programmed.
So, okay, a couple things, Mike. So there's just passive flow from the venous system through the native right atrium into this right ventricle of the TAH, but no component of atrial keg, no electrical conduction at all. It's just flowing through the atrium through a valve, and then at some point that valve closes as the flow goes out into the pulmonary artery.
Yes. So it's a passive fill-in, but the Syncardia has designed it with a little vacuum assistance. So you can turn a little bit of vacuum on to kind of help fill the pump. The one thing that I want, you know, the audience to understand is the vacuum only applies. So there's a diaphragm. You have air in one part of the chamber, and then you have blood in the other aspect of the chamber. And the blood and the air do not ever interface. It's the diaphragm. So when the suction is applied, it basically empties all the air that's, you know, based on the scale of the suction, it would empty all the air that's within the air, you know, the air chamber of the TAH ventricle. And by so doing, it does assist with, you know, pulling blood either from the, you know, left atrium into the left ventricular pump or the right atrium into the right ventricular pump. And the reality, intraoperatively, when you implant a device, the goal is not to turn the suction, the vacuum assistance on, because you may also entrain air into the pump. So this is the use of vacuum assistance is usually after chest is closed or a little later down the line when most of the anastomoses are a little bit healed, so you don't entrain air within, you know, the TAH. And to eject blood out of the pump, the pneumatic system, it has a driver which basically delivers, you know, the compressed air to the ventricle, and then the compressed air would push blood out into the pulmonic and into the systemic circulations. And the pressures are variable because obviously the right-sided pressures, the right side or the, sorry, this her system is a lower pressure system. So you typically would use a driving pressure of maybe 80 to 100, 110 to facilitate ejection of blood into the pulmonary circulation. And then on the left ventricular side, you may use pressures from 180 to 200, 210 to facilitate the delivery of blood, you know, from the TAH. And I would also emphasize one other critical point that the TAH, if there's one statement that, you know, everybody wants to take away from this podcast. It's a partial fill but full eject mechanical circulatory support. It's the only one that works based on this principle because there are two platforms for the syncardia. There's a 70 cc ventricle and a 50 cc ventricle. Promise, if you fill the ventricle all the way to the maximum capacity, you end up with back pressure, and that would cause. So, if you have a 70 cc ventricle in the left ventricular position, I mean, you always use the same ventricular capacity on the right and left. But for this example, let's say you have a 70 cc ventricle in the left ventricular, position, and then if you fill it to 70 cc capacity, there would be extra preload that would not be able to be delivered to the patient. And then that will lead to pulmonary edema. So it's very critical not to exceed the fill-in. So if the 70 cc pump, your goal fill volume is 50 to 60 mLs. And if you have the 50 cc ventricle, your goal for the fill volume is 30-40. So you give yourself a safety volume of about 10 mLs so you don't overfill the pump.
Makes sense. Okay. And this is obviously placed under bypass, right? Cardiopulmonary bypass. Stay with us. We'll be right back with Dr. Asando's answer to that question and a lot more.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
All right, we're back. And the question was, are these placed under cardiopulmonary bypass?
Yes, sir. Yeah. So the patient comes in. Yeah, you put them under cardiopulmonary bypass, do the cardiectomies, implant the both ventricles, and then you use transesophageal echo to guide you come off bypass.
Great. All right. So we talked about the components of being the two ventricles and the valves. And we talked about kind of how it works and the fact that with the new driver, patients can go home. What parameters does the total artificial heart driver monitor, especially if patients are going home? What is it showing? Do they have to make any adjustments? How does this all work?
Perfect. So there are two drivers. There's the companion two driver, which is the in-hospital big, bulky, system. That provides the clinicians with a lot of parameters, but the most important are the beat rate, which is essentially the pulse. So a TH patient actually does not have an electrocardiogram. It's an isoelectric waveform. The beat rate is selected, which can be, for example, 120. And then you have the fill volume. So the fill volumes would be, I'm basically describing the companion two driver. So it will show you fill-in of the left ventricle, and it would also show you fill-in of the right ventricle. And then you have the drive pressures, and you also have the vacuum, and then you can see, and then it has graphical representations of the fill-in, and so is it, are you partially fill-in, and are you fully ejecting? All of that will be shown on the console. And then you end up having a stroke volume and a cardiac, output based on, the fill volumes and the beat rate. When it comes to the Freedom Driver, does not really give you that many parameters. It's basically the fill, it doesn't even give you the fill volume. It gives you the beat rate, and it also gives you the cardiac index and the stroke volume. And it also has the ability to be powered not just by alternating current, but also batteries. It has two batteries. They give you 2 to 3 hours. And most patients are really, you know, educated that once you hit the 2 hour limit, if you're using the Freedom Driver with your batteries, you should try as possible to look for an alternating source so you can recharge your batteries. Because if you have battery failure, the pump would totally stop.
Great. Not a good thing. All right. So how, take us through how these are placed.
Perfect. Regarding the TAH system or the...
Yeah, the system itself. So they're obviously placed, you said they go in, they're under bypass. I guess we've covered a lot of this, but they're going to take out the ventricles, anastomose to the atria. I'm thinking more about like the anesthesia side. What are we doing on our end?
Okay, excellent. So essentially, as the and you have to be very mindful that these are really critical patients with biventricular failure. So your induction has to be really, really cautiously done. These are not bad patients, may be sick, but total artificial heart patients have a higher scale of, you know, heart failure. Because if you get acute left heart failure, that could lead to major cardiovascular collapse, and then the patient may not even make it to the point of TAH implantation. So a very cautious induction. You want to have all the hemodynamic monitoring that you need for such, you know, a major case. Transesophageal echocardiography is critical. You want to basically do an analysis to exclude any thrombus in any part of the cardiac chambers. It doesn't matter if the native valves are dysfunctional because they are all coming out. They're all going to be resected. If they have a PA catheter, essentially remove it. If they even have a central line, you just want to make sure that the central line is not encroaching into the right atrium to the point that it may potentially occlude the Sinhal valves after, you know, implantation. Then, you know, the surgeon would go on cardiopulmonary bypass. At that point in time, you know, you support your hemodynamics, but you also have to be mindful that most heart failure patients are on massive doses of vasopressors and inotropes, right? But as soon as you put a total artificial heart in, you're basically going to correct the circulatory part. The stroke volume is going to be corrected. But the severe vasoconstriction from all these toxic vasopressors and inotropes, you need to be mindful that it's important to basically de-escalate them as quickly as you can, because the pump is going to provide, if you have a 70 cc pump and it's beating at 100 times, you're going to get 7 liter cardiac output. It doesn't need high blood pressures. Syncardia actually recommends a maximum systolic blood pressure of 120 to 140 millimeters of mercury for the safe, you know, care of a TAH patient. So post implant, whilst weaning from cardiopulmonary bypass, you basically want to de-air the TAH to avoid strokes or any air emboli to any end organs. And that's why T is also critical. It helps you ensure that the Sinhal valves, the mechanical valves, are functional. It's a little difficult because the cage of the TAH is a plastic rigid material, but you can still assess. And then you slowly transition support from cardiopulmonary bypass to the total artificial heart. You want sure that the surgeon takes the cross clamp off in a timely fashion, because if the TAH starts, you know, ejecting, but the aortic cross clamp is on, you would encounter profound pulmonary edema, because you're going to back up all the pressure from the ventricle to the left atrium into the pulmonary, you know, circulation. And then once you totally get off cardiopulmonary bypass, volume management is also critical, because the TAH is designed for really low central venous pressures. So actually, our routine practice in Ohio State is when you have a TAH patient and they go on bypass, we do ultrafiltration, so we can basically reduce their preload in anticipation that when we're coming off bypass, the goal central venous pressure is supposed to be less than 10 millimeters of mercury. So if a TAH patient is in the OR, please be very judicious when you're given fluids.
Right. That's really key. Okay. So, you know, we've had a couple real kind of important things here to keep in mind. No swans, very careful with central lines, low CVP. And these are going to apply, obviously, not just during the placement of the TH, but anytime these patients come for surgery, right? You don't want to put a Swan in them ever. You want to be either avoid necklines, or if you're going to put one in, be very careful not to put it too far, and then keep the CVP low. Now, what about when you're thinking about the function and you think, all right, you know, these obviously, like anything, must have potential problems that can arise. What are some common issues that can arise, and what should people know about troubleshooting them?
Okay. So one of the main complications of the TH is the fact that it has the four mechanical valves causes hemolysis to a certain scale. And as a result, most TH patients have low hemoglobins, low hematocrit, but they tolerate it very well because they have a high cardiac output provided by, you know, the device. So when you encounter a TH patient whose hematocrit is like 21, you don't necessarily have to transfuse them, because you also have to be mindful that these patients are being bridged to heart transplantation. And the more expose them to, you know, blood, the more they may develop, you know, high antibody burden, and that would delay, you know, their transplantation. Secondly, so other things that you should always think about, if these patients come to the OR and they're a little their INR is a little on the higher side, be very cautious when you reverse your anticoagulation. I think you should always talk to the surgeons that, you know, who implanted the device, and basically do an analysis of the risk and benefits of correcting the anticoagulation. If it's hemorrhagic death, that's a different story. But if it's not, then you don't want to just give FFBs, cryoprecipitate, Kcentra, all these, you know, factors to patients, because you may essentially thrombose either the polyurethane diaphragm or the valves, and the patient may develop a stroke or other thromboembolic complications. So hemolysis is one of the limitations. Thromboembolic, you know, complications is also another, you know, complications. And just like anything, you always have to take really sterile precautions when you're doing any procedure, because these THs can also get infected. So endocarditis is actually been reported in, you know, TH patients. Other complications that you should be aware of is the device is the pumps are attached to cannulas, which basically attach to quick, you know, connects to the drive line. And the driver basically delivers compressed air to and from the total artificial heart ventricles through these cannulas. And there are reported cases of fractures of the cannulas. So if the cannula fractures and you lose an air, you really cannot pneumatically provide any power to essentially add to basically move the diaphragms and provide cardiac output. So all TH patients have a rescue kit. Some of the ways to repair such, you know, what you call it, either a cannular tear, is to just put, like, you know, tape on it. So they have these heavy duty tape. It's like a kit that you think it looks like something from Home Depot. And they are trained that if you loosen air pressure, you try to identify the source of the leak, and then you tape it, you know, with the tape. And another thing is the diaphragm rupture. So unfortunately, that's something that physiologists, nobody can fix it. So if the inner diaphragm ruptures, air can entrain within the diaphragm, and it would manifest as a really low fill volume or a low cardiac output. Unfortunately, only way to treat a diaphragm rupture is to take the patient to cardiac surgery and replace the TAH system. So there are only 12 cases of diaphragm ruptures out of the over 2,000 implants. It's associated with a high mortality rate. It's something that you should be aware of if your fill volume, so your cardiac output, drastically reduces.
Okay. So that would be a cause. Are there other causes of low fill volume that people should be aware of?
Yes. So low fill volumes can be if you have if you program, let's say, the heart rate to be, I would say hypothetically, like 160, something like that. That would provide a really low diastolic time, right? So the fill volume would be low. If the patient is really hypovolemic from, you know, diarrhea or from bleeding, they would also have low field volumes. Another critical cause of low field volumes, this is predominantly occurs during implantation. So the pumps are bulky. So to index the right pump, the only two pumps, 70cc pump, 50cc pump. So to index the right pump to a patient, we routinely measure the distance from the posterior aspect of the sternum to the 10th, to T10, to the anterior aspect of the 10th thoracic vertebrae. And if it's 10 centimeters, then the patient is screened in for the 70cc pump. If that distance is low, like maybe like 7 to 8 centimeters, then the patient is screened in for the 50cc pump. So if you place a bigger pump in the patient that should have been indexed for the smaller pump, the pump may compress the inferior vena cava, or it may also compress the left-sided pulmonary veins. And that would manifest during chest closure as an acute drop in field volume. So if you're in the OR and you implant a TAH and everything is going well, and all of a sudden your cardiac output drops, your fill volumes drop, and your blood pressure drops, it's not about giving, obviously you want to support the hemodynamics, but the right therapy, look under transesophageal echo, assess the left-sided pulmonary veins, the inferior vena cava, and 9 out of 10 times it will be cause of compression of these structures. And then that's the surgeons can, you know, find a way to treat that.
Great. All right. I'm assuming that if you found a patient down, pulseless, you know, having had a cardiac arrest with one of these in, CPR is probably not going to work very well. Is that right?
Yes. So CPR is totally ineffective. The TAH is so rigid, it's not compressible. You may actually cause more damage if it's more of a recent implant. Essentially, administering chest, you know, compression aid lead to either a graft, you know, the pulmonary artery graft or the aortic graft to either rupture or dislodge from the pumps, which may lead to exsanguination. So the TAH patient brings a totally different approach to cardiopulmonary resuscitation. It's more of you look at the device, you make sure if they are not responding 9 out of 10 times, it's either the device can fail, but it's, you know, it's more rare, but it's more, most likely it's a freedom driver with a patient whose battery has lost power. Maybe they've been, you know, walking around for more than 3 hours and they acutely lose power. So they will be pulseless. And obviously, you know, we're all going to be looking forward to doing CPR. So it doesn't work. Secondly, there's no ventricular arrhythmias. There are no atrial arrhythmias. So if you're doing CPR, if you're doing anything, if you see any noise, administering, you know, defibrillation or pacing is really not going to be effective. This is a plastic rigid pump without any AV conduction or any electrical components. It's totally run by air.
Oh, if the patient has pump failure, their only hope would be to very quickly get into the operating room. And realistically, if this happens out in the world, that's it, right? They're not going to get to a cardiac OR in time. If it happened, you know, as they were going from the OR to the ICU, you could go right back into the OR, I guess. But right, I mean, if this pump fails, it's pretty much, they're pretty much going to die. Is that accurate?
Yes, that is accurate. Yeah, if it fails, so once the pump fails, if it's a witness failure, the first thing is to make sure that you can get an electrical source and plug the pump in, because that's the first thing you should always think about. And even when they come, especially for non-cardiac surgical procedures, if the patient comes to the OR with a Freedom driver and the pump's working well, it's really critical to plug it in so you can, you know, so the batteries can charge. Because, and you can actually there's a way on the batteries to really assess how much battery life is left, you know, for the patient. The device really uses a lot of energy. The compressor uses a lot of energy to deliver, you know, air maybe 120 times a minute to a patient. So energy source is very, very critical. But other than that, all the other causes of pump failure, maybe like pump thrombosis or let's say a PE. One other thing that can happen is DVT, and it embolizes. That can also dislodge it can, you know, dislodge into the ventricle, and then your cardiac output, you know, may stop. But from the operator standpoint, things that we don't want to do to potentially cause pump failure include placing lines, you know, without transesophageal echo or fluoroscopic guidance, where the, you know, the wire can get dislodged in the mechanical valve and the pump essentially stop, or placing a Swan to monitor, you know, hemodynamics. There's no reason to monitor any pulmonary pressures, because you have no way of passing the Swan through the two mechanical valves into the pulmonary circulation. So this is just something that we should all be aware of and not even attempt to do.
Right. Are these MRI compatible or no?
No. The TAH is made of a lot of ferromagnetic material. There's ferromagnetic material in multiple parts of the device. So TAH patients have no business getting the magnetic resonance imaging. They should either get a CT or just regular radiography, but MRI is an absolute, you know, contraindication for a TAH patient.
Right. All right. That's really important. All right. So we've talked a lot about kind of what general anesthesiologists who might see a patient with a TAH need to keep in mind. No MRIs, no Swans, lines in the neck need to either not be put in or put in really high and watched very carefully. Hemodynamic goals, as we've talked about, you want to not have them have a really high afterload. CVP needs to be low. Try to avoid transfusion. They're going to be anemic and they're okay there because they have a high cardiac output. We talked about the importance of plugging in the driver if they have a freedom driver. Anything we didn't mention that you think is really important, Mike, for other than those things for folks out there to know?
I mean, I think we've covered it comprehensively. I'm trying to recall what we've done, but I just want people to understand also, yeah, the hemodynamic management is really critical. Just one blood pressure of 140 over 80 is profound hypertension for a TAH patient. And a CVP of, you know, greater than 8 is really central venous hypertension for TAH patients. So just, it's important to really get these fundamental hemodynamics in the back of your mind whenever you encounter these patients. Because if you're just given fluids because, oh, you know, my urine output is low, your urine output actually may be low because of a cardiorenal issue. Because if that CVP is 10, you're creating a lot of back pressure on the kidneys. So the transrenal perfusion is actually going to be on the lower end, and that would actually be the cause of the renal failure and not because of, quote unquote, high, you know, a pre-renal hypovolemic issue. So it's very critical for us to not use our native hemodynamics that we use for the native heart and apply the same to the total artificial heart. It's really a totally physiologically different mechanical circulatory support. And also one other thing is for LVADs, we always train that it has, you know, the LVAD is susceptible to suction events where if your preload is low, it may suck down and induce right ventricular dysfunction. The total artificial heart there's no risk for a quote unquote suction event. It basically, what comes in is what it's going to eject out.
Right. Mike, this has been super interesting and useful. I'm sure people will really appreciate all this. Thank you so much. Let's turn to the portion of our show where we make random recommendations. You've made some famous ones in the past. What do you have to recommend to folks today?
This is a good one. My wife and kids made me go watch Top Gun Maverick. It's a phenomenal, phenomenal movie. Tom Cruise was on a different level. So if anybody has any time, I really recommend that they watch this movie.
We were talking offline, and I still will say I'm so jealous. I've been wanting to see this ever since it came out. Haven't found the time yet, but I'm definitely planning on going. Huge fan of the original. Can't wait to see this one. I'm going to recommend the final season of the show This Is Us. I don't know, Mike, do you watch This Is Us? Have you ever watched it?
No, I haven't seen it.
This is the eighth and final season. It is one of the most well done, engaging shows that I've ever watched. My wife and I have been watching it for 8 years. It's incredibly well-made, powerful, emotional. I actually was talking to a colleague a few years ago. I asked if he watched it. He said he started watching it for the first few seasons and he had to stop because he was so emotionally tied up in the show that it was just too disturbing. Like he couldn't handle that. He was like crying half the time he watched it. And it really is like you really get to know the characters and feel close to them. They're wonderful actors. Anyway, the final season was really well done. I thought they ended it well. And I highly recommend the whole show. And then, of course, the final season, This Is Us. So check it out. All right, Mike, thank you so much for coming back on the show. And we'll have you again soon.
Thank you so much. It's always a privilege to be on ACT. It's really a great resource for education. Thank you.
All right. Hopefully you got as much out of that as I did. That was really fantastic. Let us know what you thought. Go to the website, acrac.com, where you can leave a comment. Others can learn from what you have to say. If you are a fan of the show, you can follow us. We're on Twitter. We are on Facebook. We are on Reddit. And we are on Instagram. I'm at Jay Wolpaw on Twitter, and we're at ACRAC Podcast. And you can find us on all those other platforms as well. If you are a fan of the show, please consider going to Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts and leaving a comment and a rating. It really helps others find the show. If you'd like to support the making of the show, please consider going to patreon.com/acrac. That's patreon.com/accrac, where you can become a patron of the show. Even if it's just a dollar or two that you pledge, it makes a big difference and we really appreciate it. You can also make donations anytime by going to paypal.me/acrac. Or looking up Jay Wolpaw on Venmo. Thank you so much to those who have already made donations and become patrons. We really appreciate it. Thanks, as always, to our fantastic ACRAC crew. Dr. Brian Park is our tech lead. Ryan Okonski is our social media manager. Dr. April Liu and Edison Jang are our production assistants. Thank you so much for all that you do. Our original ACRAC music is by Dr. Dennis Kuo. You can check out his website at studymusicproject.com. All right. That is it for today. For the ACRAC Podcast, I'm Jed Wolpaw. Thanks for listening. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.